Hi, it's Robin Young. Thank you for listening to Here and Now. If you love this show, thank you again. And you may also love other great podcasts and shows and the journalism brought to you by NPR. When you support your local public radio station, it helps us keep our program going and helps NPR create new ones. So the best way to keep both Here and Now and NPR strong is to donate to your station. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give, then share why you did using the hashtag WhyPublicRadio. Thanks.
The vote on the Republican tax cut plan could come as soon as tonight. Senator John McCain, who was thought to be on the fence, announced today that he will vote for the bill. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell speaking this morning.
We're in the stretch. You know, horse racing is kind of a big deal in Kentucky. We're going down the home stretch, headed toward the finish line either late tonight or early tomorrow.
And House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi responded.
Today in the Senate, the Republicans are racing forward with a tax scam with catastrophic consequences for America's working families.
Joining us from Capitol Hill is NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we heard McConnell say he's optimistic they're going to get to the finish line tonight or early tomorrow. Is that right? Is that expectation realistic?
That is the plan as of now, and there are signs in McConnell's favor. Of course, as we always say, this is a very narrow margin in the Senate. They only have 52 votes. They need 50 to pass it. But one positive indicator already today, Senator John McCain announced this morning that he will vote for the bill. He was one of those senators who was we were watching as a holdout. So all of the momentum is in the direction of McConnell's favor.
There have been other holdouts, though. For instance, this morning, Senator Susan Collins from Maine said she's concerned about the elimination of the federal deduction for state and local taxes. What are some of the sticking points?
One thing we're watching now is where they're going to end up on this corporate tax rate. Right now, the bill reduces the tax rate from 35 down to 20%. There's an effort by some Republicans like Marco Rubio of Florida and Mike Lee of Utah to raise that to 22% because it would give them more money to have a fully refundable child tax credit. That would be more money that goes to middle class families. And I do think that that sort of debate we're in right now also suggests that there are some Republicans who are sensitive to the fact that they want this bill to do more for working families.
Would any of them actually vote no, though, if they don't get the concessions they're asking for?
That's a great question, and it does not seem likely that at the end of the day, either a Marco Rubio or a Mike Lee will be ultimately be a no if the corporate tax rate remains at 20.
Where did all the concerns of the deficit hawks go in the Republican Party? This bill, as analysts have pointed out, is going to add a lot of money, more than $1 trillion, to the debt.
You know, I always say that deficit hawks are always the loudest when they're not the party in power. The argument Republicans are making here is a familiar one. And what they're saying is that they believe that these tax cuts are going to generate an economic boom, that they're going to increase jobs, they'll increase revenues, that will cover the cost of the bill. There's not a lot of economic precedent that you can point to say here's proof that that's going to happen. But this has always sort of been the core philosophical argument from Republicans for tax cuts.
In fact, there's a lot of evidence that points to the opposite happening,
Absolutely.
Which is that tax cuts don't end up paying for themselves. Now, the House version of this bill did not address health care, but the Senate's bill would effectively repeal Obamacare's individual mandate that people
Right.
buy health insurance. It seems like there's a lot in this bill that's not directly related to tax cuts, including opening up drilling in Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. What else is in this thing?
Those are two good examples of sort of non-tax-related policies that Republicans are trying to use to dismantle the ACA and a long-running goal to open up ANWR. One other thing is a good example of the things we're kind of going to be looking for if this passes the Senate and gets into the next negotiation phase is these differences between the two bills. Another difference is in the House bill, they also do something that's they've repealed the Johnson Amendment, which would essentially make it easier to politicize from the church pulpit. It would eliminate prohibitions on churches being able to endorse candidates and keep their tax-exempt status. The House gets rid of that. That's one of those issues that they're going to have to work out and something that, particularly from the conservative right, is really popular and would like to see included ultimately in this bill.
Now, you mentioned the next negotiation phase. This would go to conference is what you're talking about there. Is it likely there are going to be any hurdles down the road?
There's going to be a lot of hurdles. If they do pass the Senate bill this week as planned, the goal is still to pass it at the end of the month. But there are still fundamental differences between the two bills. One big
right.
one to watch for, the Senate bill makes the middle class tax cuts temporary.
Right.
The House cut makes them permanent. They're going to have to figure that out.
NPR's Sue Davis. Sue, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, in addition to the tax bill, Congress is coming up on another showdown. Lawmakers have to agree on a spending bill by December 8th to keep the government running, and Republicans need Democrats for this to pass. But Democrats say they're holding out for a deal on DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which protects some young people who came to the country illegally as children were brought here from being deported. President Trump canceled that program in September and gave Congress until March to figure out a permanent solution. And at least one Republican is joining the Democrats. Florida Congressman Carlos Curbelo joins us now. Congressman, you are refusing to vote for a spending bill for next year until there's a deal on DACA?
Well, that's right. And the truth is, this is not just a priority for Democrats. There are 35 Republicans in the House who have co-sponsored my Recognizing America's Children Act, which would provide that permanent solution for these young immigrants who are contributing to our country and who love our country. And that is why I decided to draw a line and say Congress has been debating this Dreamer issue for 16 years. The time to solve it is now, especially since we have a hard deadline in March. So my position is that I am not going to support any appropriations bill that funds the government beyond December 31st unless we have an agreement in place to solve this issue for these young immigrants, as the president, by the way, has requested that Congress do.
Well, let me pick up a couple things here. First of all, there are a couple of bills. There's the bipartisan bill, the DREAM Act, which was filed in the House and Senate. Democrats are backing that. What's the difference between your Recognizing America's Children Act and the DREAM Act? I mean, why can't you just sign on with the bill the Democrats are largely signing on?
The bills are very similar. My bill is the one that most closely tracks the DACA program that the Obama administration designed. We provide a solution for those who arrived at the country prior to the age of 16, just like DACA does. And we provide three pathways to permanent status. They have to either show that they've worked four of the last 5 years, earned a degree in higher education, or served in the military for 3 years. So this is an earned path. Some people are throwing out the word amnesty already because it's politically charged and it helps scare people in this country, and that's what some people are out there to do with this immigration issue. But this is not amnesty. This is a way for these young immigrants who never broke any law to reconcile with our legal immigration system and have a path to securing the rest of their future in this country.
Well, in fact, some would say that it's a finite group as well. They had to come here before a certain year, so it's not as if this would apply to young children who were brought here after that date. But a couple of things. Are you saying that if push comes to shove, would you just as soon sign on to the DREAM Act?
No. Look, I have said over and over again, there are many bills in the House and the Senate, I think seven, if I'm right, that would provide a permanent solution for Dreamers. And I am willing to support any of them. There's no pride of authorship here. We're actually now involved in a bipartisan effort to reconcile my Recognizing America's Children Act and the DREAM Act that was filed here in the House, and presenting that as a potential compromise that can get many Republicans and Democrats to support it.
And is it important to you that the DACA deal be standalone or be part of the spending bill? What's important to you?
What's important to me is that it gets done. I don't care if it's part of a spending bill, if it's a standalone bill, if it has to ride on an energy bill, whatever it is, this should get done by the end of the year. Some people will say, well, we really have till March. There is no sense in waiting that long. We should get it done as soon as possible.
Well, what do you say to your fellow Republicans and to President Trump, who tweeted out to Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, they want illegal immigrants flooding into our country unchecked. I don't see a deal. This is when they were supposed to be meeting on topics just like this and the budget. And, of course, the Democrats canceled that meeting because he was flagging, I don't see a deal. People are interpreting what the president is doing now as trying to make up for what appeared to many Republicans as him sort of folding on the issue of DACA when he sat down with Nancy and Chuck, weeks ago. So what do you see about this being the way this has been politicized? And it looks now as if DACA's being thrown under the bus by the president.
Yeah, two things. Number one, I don't follow the president's Twitter feed religiously because I don't have time for that. Secondly, I think Ms. Pelosi and Mr. Schumer should have gone to the White House anyway, because you can't lose anything by sitting down and having a conversation.
Even with that tweet?
Even if the president was posturing in the morning. The bottom line on this DACA issue is that the president is on the record over and over again asking Congress for a permanent solution. And that should be good enough for everyone here to get it done.
Do you agree that after the spending bill, the leverage is gone?
No. Look, obviously.
But you're saying you're not going to vote for the spending
obviously
bill.
Obviously, it's a big opportunity, and we should take advantage of it. I'm not going to tell you that if for any reason it doesn't get done in conjunction with the spending bill, that I will give up hope entirely. Yeah. I will not. But I do recognize that this is the big opportunity, and that is why I decided to take this position to apply some positive pressure on this institution to get this done after 16 years of debate. Let's get it done. Let's not waste any more time.
Representative Carlos Curbelo, Republican Congressman from South Florida, thank you.
Sure. Have a great day.
The family that lost 9 members in the Sutherland Springs, Texas church shooting is filing a lawsuit against the Air Force. It was a former Air Force member who killed 26 people and injured 20 others, and the Air Force had neglected to report a prior conviction to proper authorities, which allowed the shooter to buy weapons he should have been prevented from buying. Many also pointed to the shooter's mental health. He had escaped from a mental institution in 2012. We're going to take a look now at the state of the country's mental hospitals with Dominic Sisti, who is a medical ethicist at the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And in general, what is the state of mental health hospitals in the U.S.?
So the state is that there are very few inpatient long-term care facilities and beds available. They've basically evaporated over the past 50 years in their capacity to take care of people on an inpatient basis for more than 72 hours.
Why?
Well, there was a trend towards deinstitutionalization, which began in the 50s and the 60s. A variety of forces led to the emptying of psychiatric hospitals. State hospitals began to realize that individuals who were there probably could do well in the community, and oftentimes individuals were warehoused in these large psychiatric hospitals. So deinstitutionalization was a very good thing and a very good it was well intended. But what I believe happened over the past 50 years is that there's been such an evaporation of psychiatric therapeutic spaces that now we lack a sufficient number of psychiatric beds.
How much of that is about funding? Just states or whoever being unwilling to pay what it costs to run these institutions?
Yes. So funding is a major driver in all of this, obviously. You know, the way state hospitals were funded was through state budgets. And, of course, state budgets are rather tight and have been tight for many decades now. So there is the funding issue. But to me, you know, the trend towards deinstitutionalization was more of an ideological shift that really followed on the heels of civil rights. So the idea that individuals who were placed in mental hospitals, psychiatric institutions, really had a right to community-based care or care that was less restrictive. And in fact, the Supreme Court affirmed this view in several cases that, you know, they argue that, yeah, an individual who can live in the community ought to be accommodated in the community.
And is that what people have done? I mean, people who have gotten out of these institutions, have they been accommodated in the community?
So, yeah, so many have. And, you know, the community care movement has been successful, in, you know, in many contexts. However, there is a population that does still require, in my opinion, significant structured inpatient care. And this population it doesn't often get it. Many times individuals are who really do require intensive psychiatric care find themselves homeless or more and more in prison. Our prisons now house millions of individuals with serious mental illness. The latest statistics point to close to 25% of individuals incarcerated have a serious mental illness. Serious mental illness includes psychotic symptoms and bipolar disorder and other very severe conditions. So what we have in our hands is a serious healthcare crisis. Much of our mental health care now for individuals of serious mental illness has been shifted to correctional facilities.
I want to just go back to the funding issue, though, for a minute, because we were just recently in the state of Kansas, where one of the state's mental hospitals had to cut down on the number of patients it takes in because of short staffing, because of funding. It lost its Medicare certification after a patient allegedly raped a staff member in 2015. Are similar things happening in other states to the public hospitals?
Yes. Over the course of the last, 50 years, there's been an evaporation. But in the past, 5 to 10 years, the continued decline in hospital beds has been rather dramatic. So the ideal number of state hospital beds for an estimate for our society is about 50 per 100,000. And in most of the states that we've gathered data on, it's close to 10 to 12 beds per 100,000. So it's dramatically lower than what most health policy analysts estimate we would need for capacity.
What about private mental health hospitals? How are they doing?
So private mental health hospitals are around, obviously. They exist. Many do not take health insurance, or if they do take health insurance, it's for a limited time based on the plan. So it's a problem because these very elite, high-quality private hospitals cost upwards to $30,000 a month, and this is private pay only. So many individuals are left out who really do need psychiatric care. Many are individuals who want that psychiatric care. This is not about involuntary treatment. This is about individuals who actually are seeking out care.
And at that price, do they work? Are they effective?
Oh, yeah, many do. And they're not just hospitals. They're also various settings like farmsteads and therapeutic communities. There's a variety of modalities that exist, and many, you know, the outcomes are good. The problem is the supply is quite low for the demand.
And are people typically put in these hospitals voluntarily or involuntarily?
So both. The number of individuals who find themselves in psychiatric hospitals these days are there often involuntarily, because that's the sort of route into these places. The shortage is such that individuals who would go voluntarily don't either have the money or the resources to get into a hospital. So it is true that many are there now involuntarily. And the way they get there involuntarily is if they're determined to be somehow a risk to themselves or to some other person.
Do they have any rights once they get in over their own treatment? Any control over that?
Oh, absolutely. So what's interesting about this situation is an individual can be involuntarily committed to a psychiatric hospital, but they retain the right to decline medical care once in the hospital. So you might imagine, wow, they're incapacitated or incompetent and they've been involuntarily committed. That means they should be treated, you know, against their will, I guess, and they should not be involved in decision making for their care. But that's not actually how it works. Individual capacity is ascertained on a very decision-specific basis. So an individual who is, again, institutionalized involuntarily can say, you know what, I had a bad experience with that medication. I don't want that medication. Let's look for another treatment. I don't want, say, electroconvulsive therapy because I'm worried about side effects. Whatever it is, they do retain control over specific decisions. Now, some will be so psychotic or mentally ill that they're just completely incapacitated. And in those cases, oftentimes it's the caregivers who make those decisions. But the question about retaining rights, absolutely they do.
Aside from the shortage of funding in some of these public hospitals, there have also been horror stories of abuse, of squalid facilities, and other problems. Is there oversight? Is there accountability for these hospitals?
So, yeah, I mean, I think that you touched there on one of the main drivers of deinstitutionalization, which was, in fact, several scandals in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s that exposed some of these awful places for what they were. And there really wasn't good oversight at the time for these hospitals. Now, there were really good functional psychiatric hospitals even then, but the scandals overtook, you know, the reputations of the good ones. So today, there are oversight regimes, everything from the Joint Commission to the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare, that come in and audit psychiatric hospitals regularly to make sure that they're safe and being run in an ethically administered way. Is there enough? It's hard to say. I mean, there will be always some potential for trouble, as there are in regular hospitals and there are in schools and places, you know, any institution. But yes, there are oversight mechanisms for these places.
And going back to the issue of mass shootings and the connection with mental illness, do you see a connection between the state of our mental health hospitals and some of these mass shootings that we've seen?
It's a really complicated question. Most individuals with serious mental illness are not violent. The problem, as I see it, is the access to military-grade firearms, frankly. And so there are many countries in the world with the same incidence of serious mental illness, and they don't experience the level of mass violence that we see in this country. So while mental illness does play a role in some violent episodes, my view is that it's as much an issue about access to firearms as it is to lack of mental health care.
One more thing. Obviously, there is a stigma of mental illness. Healthcare providers say it can deter people from seeking treatment. Do you think that the stigma is still a major problem in getting people to go and get care?
You know, I do and I don't. I think that people have become much more open about their challenges in regard to mental health. But yes, there remains a stigma that's been systematized, let's say, in our health policy, which is to say that health insurers and even healthcare providers view mentally ill individuals with rather leery about these individuals, because these people are often, at least according to the stereotype, high cost patients who maybe are difficult to treat or noncompliant. And so I think the stigma that we should be really focused on and worried about actually emerges out of our healthcare system more than from the public.
That's Dominic Sisti, who is director of the Scattergood Program for Applied Ethics in Behavioral Health and assistant professor of medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Dominic, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The New York Giants are benching quarterback Eli Manning for their game this weekend. It is an extraordinary move because Manning has started 210 straight games for the Giants and has led them to two Super Bowl victories. But this season, the Giants have only won two games and have lost nine, so Manning is perhaps paying the price for that terrible record. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
So the Giants are taking a lot of heat for this move and the way it was handled. Was it warranted?
I think not, and I think the way it was handled was certainly a bungled job. So you have the Giants coach, Ben McAdoo, sort of off the cuff saying, oh, by the way, we have a little personnel decision to announce. You know that guy who's taken 14,000 snaps under center? You know that guy who has the second longest streak in the history of the NFL for not missing a start? Yeah, he won't be playing. Eli Manning, two-time Super Bowl MVP, is not good enough to lead this 2-9 team. And that was kind of shocking. It was a slap in the face to Manning. Now, when you say it wasn't warranted, the question is, okay, that's great. I mean, a lot of guys have a really good resume, right? Joe Montana won a bunch of Super Bowls. The guy's also 61 years old. I don't want him stepping on the field tomorrow. Was Manning bad? Manning was mediocre this year. But mediocre means, you know, it's a hard position to play. And it means that if he had an offensive line and if he had good receivers, I think he could have done okay. He was treated rather shabbily.
So was McAdoo doing this to save his own job?
You know, I think it actually, maybe he thought he was. Maybe he thought that he needed to do something desperate. And when an NFL coach needs to do something desperate, you change quarterbacks. And also, it's true that it's not as if Giants fans were thrilled with Manning's play. Look at the 2-9 record. He rightly comes under much criticism. So perhaps that was his motivation. I think it damned him, in fact, and all the papers, the headlines today are that the Giants owner will not give McAdoo a reassurance that he won't be fired during the season. So that tells you what you need to know.
There have been other examples of this in the NFL this year. The Buffalo Bills benched their starting quarterback as well, which you say was a crazy move.
Yeah, of course, there are many examples of benching quarterbacks, and it's the most important position in any sport, the most outsized important position in of all the professional sports. But with Buffalo, you had Tyrod Taylor, who would frustrate fans because he wasn't perfect on third down, and you could nitpick things. But by every statistical and empirical measure, was actually an above-average quarterback, especially when you take into account the fact that he could run. And Sean McDermott, new coach of the Bills, decided to bench him. It was shocking to people. And his replacement, Nathan Peterman, throws 5 interceptions in the first half of the game that he replaces him, making everyone in Buffalo and beyond say, yeah, maybe we'll stick with Tyrod.
On the other hand, the Patriots coach, Bill Belichick, has been criticized for leaving Tom Brady in the game when the Patriots are way ahead. So it can go both ways.
I guess it could go both ways. I mean, there's a lot. There's a big football media industrial complex, so you've got to criticize everyone and criticize everything. I don't see Brady's getting hurt in garbage time, and I do see tons and tons of rings on both Belichick and Brady's fingers. I don't know if there is a right answer when, you know, when you're up by 30 and there's 2 minutes left, why not play the backup? But that absolutely works for the Patriots, and I think it also sends the message of excellence, and we're going to keep with our excellent player because that's what they want and that's what he wants.
It's working. Mike Pesca
here for some of these teams.
Yeah. Here Now Sports Analyst. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Russian composer Sergei Prokofiev created one of the most famous ballet scores of all time. That's from Romeo and Juliet, which premiered in 1938 after Prokofiev, who left Russia after the revolution, went back to what had become the Soviet Union. Just one thing that made him unusual, another. As a boy, he loved stilts. And this section from Romeo and Juliet, Dance of the Night. Both the walk-on for Iron Maiden and the theme for The Apprentice in the UK, the most classical music-sounding example of men fighting. And, of course, we learn all this from classical music columnist Fran Hoffner, who takes a slightly different view of classical music in her column for The All. She joins us now. And, Fran, we also learn from you that this is Prokofiev Month, or did you just make that up?
I've made it up. Oh. It's my personal holiday.
Because why? You're reading a book.
I am. I'm working my way through Harlow Robinson's Sergei Prokofiev biography right now.
Okay. Well, tell us why you love him so much. And especially, I think you wrote last year, this time of year, everybody wants to hear something about the Nutcracker. And you say, you know, you'll be fine. We're not going to do that. We're going to do Romeo and Juliet because it's a blast. Why?
Oh, it's so much fun. And this is a piece that I played when I was in college. And a lot of my past college and high school pieces are maybe a point of trauma. But this was one I just loved. And it had that perfect intersection of sounding a little old-fashioned, but also modern and crazy, and has such colorful percussion, which is what I played.
Right.
So I have such a fondness for it.
You get to play the tambourine. We'll discuss in a moment. But first,
yeah.
Who's Prokofiev? You write kind of always unhappy, overshadowed by other Russian composers like Rachmaninoff and Stravinsky. Who was he?
You know, he was an early 20th century Russian composer and pianist. And for the first part of his career was really just known as a pianist and could never really break through ahead of Rachmaninoff or Rimsky-Korsakov or Stravinsky because he was always sort of just a little younger, a little in the shadows compared to them.
Okay, well, something of a child prodigy. Had already composed 2 operas by the time he entered the St. Petersburg Conservatory at 13. His Toccata for Piano from 1912, one of his earliest well-known works. Let's listen.
Thank you.
you know, someone here just said that it's a little like Billy Joel, moving on. But it's hard to play, and you're right. What a weird and wonderful piece of music, almost like the soundtrack of someone tearing apart their room trying to find a pair of keys.
Yeah, there's so much frustration in it, and it really speaks to, I think, the youth that he had at this time. It's sort of bursting out of him through that main D note on the piano, and it's like he's rushing to prove something. It's moving so quickly.
You know, and how does it fit into, you know, where would it be, pre-revolutionary Russia?
He's still kind of drawing on Stravinsky and this kind of dissonance that is spreading throughout modern Russian classical music.
Yeah. So he was given permission to leave after the 1917 Russian Revolution. He was considered a musical revolutionary, so revolution officials let him travel, went to the U.S., only stayed for 2 years. Why such a short time?
He did not have a great time in the U.S. You know, unlike Dvorak, he wasn't really trying to discover anything in America. He was really just trying to make money and compose more. And Americans really did see him mostly only as a pianist and not so much a composer. He just wanted so much attention all the time. And I think he couldn't get it in America.
So back to Russia. Well, Stravinsky was here. And so that's a problem. He goes back to Russia in 1936. In 1938, when he was 47, he was commissioned by the Kirov Ballet to compose Romeo and Juliet. Let's listen to Juliet's theme. Talk more about Romeo and Juliet.
I just absolutely love this ballet, and I think it brings in some of the texture of Prokofiev's early work that you see in the Toccata, but also blends it with an almost cinematic feel. They were trying to legitimize ballet more in the first half of the 20th century, so it wasn't such a like frivolous kind of nutcracker-esque type of art, but something like it's really serious that had dramatic weight to it, and I think this ballet sort of reflects that step up.
Now we're hearing the tambourine in the background there. That is what you played in school when this was performed.
Yeah, during this part I played auxiliary percussion, and I was lucky enough to be the tambourine player for this particular movement.
Because why? I mean, it's just the tambourine, but why?
The percussion is the backbone of this entire piece, at least. The snare and the tambourine and the triangle really maintain an almost like militaristic rhythm throughout this dance.
You said you felt like a profound, well, you often lace profanities through your column. You felt kind of dumb. But it works.
It does. The tambourine's an instrument that I have a lot of animosity towards because I think it's hard. You have to have a lot of confidence, I think, to be a tambourine player that I maybe don't have.
Oh, well, we learned something there. Well, let's listen to a little of Mercutio's theme. This is when, you know, the main guy's best friend, as you write, enters the scene. So here we have some xylophone, and if this isn't Enter Best Friend music, I don't know what is. Tell us more about this.
I love how upbeat and kooky and jaunty it is. It's almost a little funny, too, and I think it really captures the playfulness of Mercutio, the character, and brings a lot of life back into that story.
Yeah, well, and it helps you make your bed faster this weekend.
Yeah, that's true.
Pick the case. Prokofiev was attacked for producing music that rejected classicism. Soviet officials labeled his music anti-democratic formalism and a danger to the Soviet people. You know, what a fate.
Yeah, he really ended his career in a bit of a lull.
I'll say.
Yeah.
But why should we seek him out? Why should we listen to more?
You know, Prokofiev exists right on the cusp of the Russian Revolution. He really came of age during it. And while he always admitted he didn't really care about politics or didn't want to get involved, I think the push and pull between times and schools of thought really impacted his music nonetheless. So it's really interesting to hear a transitionary voice. Yeah. In Russian classical music.
And a relatively recent one. He died in 1953, the same day as Joseph Stalin. So he gets overshadowed again.
Yeah, they had to wait to announce his death. Poor guy.
Poor guy. Well, we give him his due now. Let's go out with a balcony scene music from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. Fran Hofner has declared this Prokofiev month, and she writes the classical music column for The All. By the way, what book are you reading? And it's a big one, so that's why you've declared it Prokofiev month.
It is a big one. It's Harlow Robinson's 1987 biography.
Okay. Fran, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Okay, we can now remove our party hats. Thank you for celebrating Prokofiev month with us.
Tomorrow marks the deadline for a decision from President Trump on whether or not he will relocate the U.S. embassy in Israel. In June, he signed a waiver delaying the move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem for 6 months. But in a speech at the United Nations on Tuesday, Vice President Mike Pence said that Trump is, quote, actively considering when and how to make the move. Aaron David Miller is a distinguished scholar in the Middle East program at the Wilson Center. He's a former advisor to Republican and Democratic secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations, and he joins us now. Welcome back.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Jeremy.
And you say that recognizing Jerusalem as Israel's capital would be the single dumbest move this administration has made in the Middle East. Why?
I know that seems somewhat hyperbolic, but in large part because there's not a single compelling American national interest, in my judgment, that would impel, compel, or justify that action. And it's not the question of whether or not our embassy belongs in West Jerusalem. It does. I think that that Israel is in the anomalous position of being the only country in the world in which the United States does not have its embassy in the host country's preferred capital of choice. But the reality is, what does the United States get out of this, and what are the risks? The Jerusalem Embassy Law, which was passed by Congress in 1995, has a national security waiver provision. And again, exercising the waiver, which is done every 6 months, does not mean that the president is going to move the embassy. The language calls for opening an embassy. An argument has been made that the president simply doesn't have to sign the waiver. And if he doesn't sign the waiver, the State Department's budget for building and appropriations is cut by 50%, which would give the department a real incentive, according to some, to see about opening an embassy in Jerusalem. But on policy grounds alone, it frankly would undermine any semblance of the United States as an effective broker in these negotiations, and it would push to the front of the pile the one issue. And at Camp David in July 2000, negotiations all but collapsed over the issue of Jerusalem. I mean, I was there. I remember it quite well. And I think what would happen is you would have a situation in which the whole focus of Jerusalem would not be on the embassy. It would end up being where it's been most often in the past, on the holy overlapping sacred space, the Haram Sharif, Har HaBayit, the whole issue of the Temple Mount and the two mosques. And I think in the end, Jeremy, I don't understand what we get out of the deal.
So why do you think the Trump administration has been pushing for this? And it sounds like more than ever.
I think, and I will make this prediction, by the time, assuming the president serves a four-year term, I suspect that by the end of that term, the administration will have made a decision to actually not move the embassy, but to open an embassy in some fashion in Jerusalem. I think the reason is, I think ideologically and politically, this administration is determined to break new ground in the U.S.-Israeli relationship. You had Mr. Trump visiting Israel earlier than any of his predecessors. You had Mr. Trump, the first American president, to actually pray at the Western Wall. You've got a president who I think is interested in breaking crockery, and a set of advisors, it seems to me, perhaps now with Mr. Tillerson, rumors of his departure and the entrance of Mike Pompeo, you may have less pushback from, not from General Mattis, but perhaps from Mr. Pompeo. So I think this, the moon, the sun, and the stars are aligning for this move. It's just I'm not persuaded it'll happen. Well, it'll happen on December 1st.
You brought something up that I do want to ask you about in the minute or so that we have left, which is there is a New York Times report, and others are reporting this as well, that President Trump is planning to replace Secretary of State Rex Tillerson with the CIA Director Mike Pompeo. Now, NPR has not confirmed that, but what would the broader implications of that be in your view?
I mean, I think that any Secretary of State, whether it's Mike Pompeo or someone else, will fundamentally face the same problem that Mr. Tillerson faced. They're going to be sandwiched between a cruel and unforgiving world in which there are very few fixes to any of the problems out there for the United States. On one hand, an unpredictable, idiosyncratic president who appears not to value diplomacy, have little regard for the State Department, or for a coherent foreign policy process. I will say this. If Mike Pompeo does, in fact, get the job, one thing will happen. The railroad is going to run a lot more smoothly. They're much closer, the two of them, than Mr. Tillerson was with Mr. Trump, and they share proclivities on policy issues, North Korea and Iran. They're much closer there as well.
And the reporting is indicating that Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas would replace Pompeo at CIA. Again, NPR hasn't confirmed that, but we will keep an eye on that story. Aaron David Miller, distinguished scholar at the Middle East Program at the Wilson Center. Always a pleasure to have you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.